Really excited to speak with all of you and want to run through a number of issues and maybe share my broader outlook on what the current status of our human dealings with animals is, and then to talk to you about where we go from here. You can see that our logo, as I mentioned to the animal law class, really tells a lot of the story of who we are. It's 19 different animals in the shape of the United States, so we're for all animals. We're looking to deal with the issues on a big scale, on a national scale, and as Mimi mentioned, we're really working on global issues. This slide, I think, really represents one of the central arguments that I advance in my book, The Bond, that our human relationship with animals is fraught with contradictions. We talk about love and appreciation for animals, we have legal standards to protect animals, yet in the very same culture that all of that exists to the good, we've got nature programs, we've got enormous publishing with animals, we have pets in our household, so many different aspects of this. In that very same culture, we have so much cruelty, and not just random acts of cruelty, institutionalized forms of cruelty where animals are legally and routinely used and tormented and dealt with in a way that treats them more like a commodity or a thing than a living being. So this, if there's any one takeaway, this is it. How do we reconcile this inconsistency in our behavior? You know, more to the point of our pro-animal sentiments and instincts, the book that Mimi mentioned and that I mentioned is called The Bond because I really do believe that we have a bond with other creatures. We all see this and feel this as children. And if you watch any kid around animals, you see that they're drawn to animals. They know that animals are different. But the differences aren't disqualifying. The differences make the animals more interesting and more exciting. They have beautiful eyes, they have beautiful fur, they're athletic. So kids are drawn to animals. And we, as a species, are drawn to animals and have always historically been drawn to animals. From the days as tribal societies and hunters and gatherers, when we were immersed in nature, and where even tribal societies kept wild animals as pets, certainly in the Amazon and New Guinea and other parts of the world. Today, when we think of ourselves as removed from nature and in what we call civilization, with so many of us living in cities and suburbs, we still crave interactions with nature. We still crave interactions with animals. And 2/3 of American households have pets, 171 million or so dogs and cats in our homes. We spend more than $50 billion a year on them. There's pet health insurance. It's not just Obamacare. There's actually pet health insurance that's offered by a whole range of companies when we're talking about health insurance issues. We have this relationship with them where my dog sleeps in my bed. The cat walks on the kitchen table. We treat these animals as members of the family. And so many of us have this incredible connection with them. We're also drawn to wildlife. There are so many animals all over. Wild animals live in the cities, they live in the suburbs, they live in what we think of as parks or wilderness areas. We make treks to wild places. 300 million of us visit America's national parks every year. Tens of millions visit refuges and national forests. We go to state parks. We go to city parks, even in places which are kind of the height of human civilization and concentration of human density. The city planners built nature reserves right in the middle of the parks. New York City has Central Park because we need a connection with nature. It's part of our DNA. It's where we came from as a species. So it's not unusual for us to love animals. It's not odd. These are universal values. These are universal behaviors. And we have modern manifestations of these connections with animals. And we have 20,000 plus animal protection organizations. The Humane Society of the United States is the largest of them, but there are local groups, there are national groups, there are global groups. There's a kind of group for every kind of animal. There are big cat sanctuaries. There are chimp sanctuaries. There are guinea pig sanctuaries. There are rabbit sanctuaries. We run a rabbit sanctuary in South Carolina for injured and homeless rabbits. And our motto is, we provide hope for the hopless. And for so many people, this is an expression of their humanity, that they are concerned about these other creatures. And this is a remarkable statement of who we are, 20,000 groups. I mean, the notion that we're going to be caring for animals, rescuing animals, fighting cruelty, is a mainstream notion. I mean, when you have groups in every community in the United States organized to drive those sensibilities, that's a reflection or a manifestation of that. Yet the flip side of that is, why do we need 20,000 animal protection organizations? How have we skidded so far off the tracks to create such a need, so that that level of volunteerism, that level of paid labor, that level of emotional energy and assistance is required to turn around the problems? And this relates to this incredible set of contradictions that exist in our behavior with animals. This is the first chairman of the board of the Humane Society of the United States. And when this group was formed in the mid-1950s, the state of the animal welfare movement was that there were shelters and a lot of communities around the U.S. Not all of them, and still not all of them, have an organized Humane Society or SPCA or animal care organization. But what Robert Chenoweth and others felt was that in order to complement that work, we need to strike at the root causes of cruelty. We can't rescue our way out of these problems. We actually need to prevent cruelty, and we need to prevent animals from getting into bad situations, and we need to challenge institutionalized exploitation of animals. At the time, whether it was dog dealing for research or dog fighting or inhumane slaughter, there needed to be a group that was focused on those problems. And while the issues have changed and the material circumstances have changed, that notion is still so relevant today, that if we just focus on rescuing animals in distress, we're not doing enough to address the problems. So we actually have a whole network of organizations. The Humane Society of the U.S. is at the center, but we've got a Humane Society International and a land trust and other entities, and we attack the problem like a business would attack some entrepreneurial challenge. We have veterinarians and policy experts and undercover investigators and medical doctors and artists and video folks and lawyers and scientists, because we're trying to turn around some of the biggest industries in the United States, and you can't do it with reason and logic alone. You've got to be organized in order to address these problems. And these are the four areas in which we work. We do a tremendous amount of rescue and direct care of animals. We try to educate the public and make them aware of these problems and give them options in their lives. And we do public policy and enforcement, and we work with the biggest corporations in the country. Today, we just had the latest in a series of raids in Alabama on dogfighting. This is an image from the end of August where we raided 13 different dogfighting operations on one morning with the FBI and with county sheriffs and others, and rescued 367 dogs who are destined for fighting pits. And our rescue teams respond to all sorts of cases, whether it's hoarding cases involving iguanas or dogs or cats or other animals. We have urban-based programs that give people who are economically disadvantaged free opportunities for spay and neuter and vaccination and pet food and toe trimming and all sorts of things. We have veterinarians who go to many of the most rural reaches of the U.S. and we help animals who are in need and the people who care about them. And we also do wildlife response. We do international programs. I was mentioning earlier there are tens of thousands of people who die every year from rabies. Is there 250 million plus street dogs roaming the streets in developing countries? They don't have the network of shelters that we have. And these dogs can transmit zoonotic diseases, including rabies, and we're addressing this by sterilizing these animals, reducing the population, building tolerance levels, and promoting public health. And our teams, this is an image just from a couple of days ago in Tacloban in the Philippines, where we've got veterinary teams who are helping the animals in these disaster zones. And we do this all over the world. And I want to show you just a little bit about our teams in action. This is one of our animal rescue videos. It was one of our rescue videos. There it is.
Some years ago, I lived a hard life, but sunlight burst a ray through those clouds.
They survived a tornado. Now we have to help them before the bulldozers come.
It's really sad to see them in this condition, and I'm glad we're here to help them today.
She's been through a lot of pain. But not anymore, not today.
You ready to go?
Let's go.
I'm going to share something that these guys have never had. This is going to be interesting for them.
You found yourself on the road. Inside your winter coat. Leave your troubles behind now.
So our animal rescue team and our volunteers would be the first to tell you that that is incredible, life-saving work, but they want us to get at the root cause of the problem. They can't handle the many, many crisis situations that come up. There are more of those situations than we can possibly attend to. And that's why I said we can't rescue our way out of the problem. So many of these industries are operating perfectly legally. The notion of rescue is a misapplication when you're talking about factory farming or animal testing. You can't rescue those animals. There are too many of them. There are billions of animals in these situations, and it's legal. So that's why we focus on institutional cruelty. And you know, the bedrock of this are state anti-cruelty statutes. And now every state in the country has an anti-cruelty law. And this is a map of the country, of course, and there are three keys in this map. This is the state of the law on these three areas in 1985. If you can see the light blue pit bull type dog, the top one, right under the year 1985, represents a state with felony dogfighting laws, about 10 or 12 or so in 1985. The rooster, the white rooster, represents felony cockfighting laws. You can see just a few states, Wisconsin, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, so a few of the New England states, but just a handful. And then the orange cat represents felony-level penalties for certain malicious acts of cruelty. So I thought to myself when I started at HSUS, I said, if we're not treating malicious cruelty seriously, how can we possibly address these other serious problems? So we resolved to change the legal framework, and we've been doing it state by state, issue by issue, and now this is what the map looks like, as we've been fortifying this legal framework year after year to protect animals from this sort of malicious cruelty. And we also deal with other forms of animal cruelty, parochial or narrow forms of cruelty like horse soaring. I don't know if many of you have heard of this, but in the Tennessee walking horse industry, there are folks who injure the feet of the horses in order to get them to exaggerate their gait, and if they have a higher stepping gait, it wins prizes at horse shows. And I'll just show you a short portion of a video about horse soaring, just so you begin to understand what the issue is.
Where is
the exaggerated steps these horses are taking is what trainers want, and some will stop at nothing to achieve it. That gait is called the big lick.
These are people who see horses as a thing, and they're going to manipulate them and abuse them to get the result that they want.
This abuse is known as soaring.
Soaring involves the application of caustic chemicals, including oil of mustard, croton oil, diesel fuel, and other irritants that are applied to the pasterns or ankles of the horse's feet.
These chemicals literally cooked into their skin overnight.
The horse is allowed to wear up to a 6-ounce chain in the show ring, and sometimes during training, they'll use a much heavier chain. All that action of the chain hitting that sensitized tissue of the horse's pastern causes extreme pain and causes the horse to lift his feet higher, producing the desired gait or big lick that's prized in the show ring. Jackie McConnell was on probation during our investigation for his past transgressions of the law. This guy was continuing to operate. He's doing it under somebody else's name, and he's abusing these horses in some of the worst ways we've seen in this industry.
I've been pretty good. Yeah. You ain't had no complaints, have you?
It's appalling, it's cruel, and it's illegal.
The longer that I worked the stable, I became more and more aware of just how much pain these horses were in every day. They struggled really hard just to get up from laying down, but many times they were suffering so much they just couldn't. This angered the workers and made them whip the horses violently and even drag them by their heads.
Get your ass.
Tennessee walking horses have a fantastic temperament, and unfortunately, some trainers take advantage of that. Animals being used to entertain people, making money for the trainers and the owners, and this is how we repay these horses with cruelty and abuse?
I've never seen horses in so much pain than I have at this training stable.
There's something really awful at work here. And if those spectators could see the true face of soaring, they'd be running these people out of the business. You can see that we deal with some pretty difficult issues, and our undercover investigators penetrate to really show the public the reality. You know, that point that I was making, if the public knew, people would be outraged. So we're trying to show them the reality. other forms of cruelty like bear baiting, which we just ended. The issue of euthanasia of dogs and cats, so many of us are familiar with the local shelter in our community, and euthanasia is still something that's occurring all too frequently in our society. This is a graph that shows the number of pets in households. So in the mid-70s, about 63 million dogs and cats. Now it's a little more than 170 million. This is the number of animals euthanized. So you can see that even as we're getting more animals in our homes and there are more animals in our community, total population has increased, the numbers of animals being euthanized is declining, which is a good thing. But it's still about 3 million. And the way we're attacking this is by encouraging adoption of animals from shelters, not going to pet stores, not going to internet sites that are supplied by puppy mills, going to the local shelter, getting a great animal, saving a life, getting a double bottom line benefit. You get a great animal in your life, and you also achieve this broader social purpose that we have of ending euthanasia of helpless animals. Shutting down puppy mills is one of our goals. This is the legal framework as it exists now. We've been methodically improving that standard. 34 states in the last 5 years have adopted standards, and Virginia was one of the first in that wave to adopt a stronger statute on puppy mills. The Congress just the Obama administration just adopted stronger standards on this issue as well. We've been working to eliminate gas chambers as well. In many rural parts of the country, they're killing animals by gassing them in chambers, and we've been working to outlaw that all across the country as well. There are also a lot of folks who have a fascination with animals, but they want to have wild animals as pets. And this almost never turns out well for the animals, and it often turns out badly for the people. People have lions, chimpanzees, bears, macaques, all sorts of animals as pets. And when they become too unmanageable, too big, too powerful, they release them, they relinquish them, and then we get held, or we have to hold the bucket for them and care for these animals for the rest of their lives. So you can see we've been changing the legal standards on this issue as well. And this is an issue that we've been working on for a few years, the use of chimpanzees in invasive experiments in laboratories. The U.S. has been, in recent years, the only nation in the world that allows invasive experiments on chimpanzees, whose numbers in the wild are declining and whose intelligence is almost beyond comparison in the animal kingdom. They're said to share 98% of the genetic material with humans. And they are sociable, they are problem solvers, they've been able to engage in rudimentary human language with American Sign Language. And we have been working to get them out of laboratories. And just this past week, the Congress passed legislation to fund the transfer of chimps from laboratories to sanctuaries. We had already been working on that and succeeding. And we're hoping that this blue line, which is the number of chimps in labs, is going to go to zero quite soon, and the number in sanctuaries is going to rise. And I want to show you one more video, because I think that this tells the whole story.
Ultimately, the provision of space and the ability to live in large groups can enhance a chimpanzee's life.
We are bringing in 111 additional chimpanzees.
It will double Chimp Haven's population, and it's definitely a turning point in our campaign. We're starting to see more chimpanzees go into retirement as we've been successful over the years.
I've worked with chimps for over 15 years, and I've worked with them in the laboratory environment prior to coming to Chimp Haven. And to witness chimps coming out into the natural habitat after seeing what they've been exposed to in the past is rewarding beyond anything that I can say.
10-4, Melanie, everybody in place.
Seeing the chimps step out into the yards for the first time and to be kind of faced with all of this immense space where they just sit and look up and with this awe of amazement, like there's no bars above me. It's just absolutely phenomenal to witness. Several of us have known some of these chimps prior to them being here, and to actually see them step on ground for the first time and not be very unsure about it because they never touched it before, or to see another chimp and realize there's no bars between you, and to be able to groom and just learning the dominance hierarchy, who's going to be submissive in a group and who's going to be dominant. It's a very exciting process. It's amazing to witness, and it really is a testament to how much the chimps grow once they get here to Chimp Haven.
This is unprecedented. This is the largest group of government-owned chimpanzees to be retired from a laboratory.
And now these chimpanzees get to come out and be in big groups and exhibit the same type of behavior that their wild counterparts would do. It makes me speechless.
We believe that these chimpanzees who have given so much to humankind, that it's only fitting that we give back to them and let them enjoy their retirement years in as close to a natural habitat as we can possibly create for them.
Some of these chimpanzees are over 50 years old. So it's incredible to see that, you know, they came from the wild where they were able to climb trees, and now they're back to climb trees in a more natural setting. This is not like anything we're able to do usually. Working on animal research, you prevent additional research often, but you don't actually physically see animals make it out to a place like this. So this is a huge victory, and there are hundreds more in laboratories, and we're very close to getting them here. It's been a long road.
So now we're closer than ever because of the action that Congress took, and we're working with the National Institutes of Health to get just about all of those chimpanzees to these sanctuaries. And to think of these animals, decades they've been living in laboratories, some of them in isolation or very small social groups. I mean, I just think we're going to look back and wonder how we could do these things to these incredible, intelligent, sociable animals. And we're working broadly on animal testing. We just banned cosmetic testing in India. Cosmetic testing on animals. The European Union just now stipulates that any cosmetics marketed throughout the EU, the 27 or so members of the EU, there can be no animal testing that goes on at any point in the process for those products, even if they're coming from out of the country. And then China was requiring that all cosmetics are tested on animals, even if they had been proved safe previously somewhere. So now they've just relaxed those standards, and we're going to be working with China, so some of the biggest economies in the world, but we still have progress to make in the United States. The number of animals used in research and testing had been going up for a while, and now it's beginning to decline, and we're seeing more innovation, more good science, and less reliance on just using animals because they're there, because that's the way a lot of people have been trained for a long time. You know, there are a whole range of different issues with animals, and one might debate about medical testing or animal testing and might say, okay, well, it's a balance between animals and people. Well, no one can really make an argument that we need to kill animals for fur. I mean, if cruelty to animals is logically defined, it means causing unnecessary harm to animals, that it's not needed for survival. Well, we don't need to kill animals for their fur because we have synthetic coats and natural fiber coats that are just as warm and just as stylish. We don't need to do this. So killing seals in Atlantic Canada, which historically has been the largest marine mammal kill in the world, when we started our campaign in 2005, there were 400,000 seals being killed every spring. Newborn babies, the mothers swim down pregnant from Greenland down the long, jagged Atlantic coast of Quebec and Labrador and Newfoundland, and they give birth to these babies on the vast ice floes to the east of the North American continent. There are no polar bears out there. There's no human settlement. It's just ice on top of the ocean. And that was a safe place for these baby seals because for the time that they're with their mothers, which is just 12 days, they can't run because they don't have legs. They can't swim. But unfortunately, these sealers came, these men in boats came with clubs and guns to kill them, not for local use. These are not native people who are, you know, Inuit or other tribal societies that are consuming the meat for food. This is an export market hunt. They kill the babies, they peel off the fur, they leave the carcasses to rot. And we've been working to close markets all over the world. You can see the blue line at the top is the quota set by the federal government of Canada. And when we started our campaign, you can see that they were basically meeting that quota, that the sealers would go out and kill nearly 400,000 seals. And we began to close markets. We got the entire European Union to ban imports of seal products from this hunt, Mexico, and then we got Russia, Kazakhstan, and Taiwan, and other countries to do the same. And you can see that the hunt has declined. They're still killing tens of thousands of seals, but the government is buying up the seal pelts, and they're warehousing them. No one wants these seal pelts. So you have so many cases of animal cruelty where there's just this stubborn allegiance to doing something over and over again because that's the way it's been done for so long, even beyond its economic utility. The entire hunt had gross revenues of a little more than $1 million, and the government of Canada spent $5 or $10 or $15 million, we can't quantify precisely how much, to subsidize the operation. If you look at all of the true costs of the hunt, the whole thing is a net loser. So killing animals is not always a way to profit. It is often archaic, not just morally, but also economically. And again, we won't be satisfied until we end the fur trade. There's no excuse for killing animals in steel jaw traps or snares or raising them on factory farms for mink or chinchilla or bobcats or other animals to adorn ourselves. Again, it's the very definition of cruelty. And there are other forms of cruelty, like sharks killed for their fins, with shark fin soup really being a tradition in a few Asian countries. It's served at banquets and weddings and other major occasions. Well, the people of China are waking up and saying they don't want anything to do with it. And India just banned it. We're working. We just banned it in these 8 coastal states in the U.S., including in California, which has the largest Chinese-American population. And surveys of Chinese-Americans show that upwards of 80% of them want to ban the killing of sharks for their fins. And again, talking about taking a shark out of the water, pulling the shark out, cutting off his fins, and throwing the animal mutilated back into the water to die a miserable death just for a bowl of soup. And the fin itself is thought to be completely tasteless. So to have this kind of completely unnecessary appetizer and to cause this amount of suffering, I mean, when we're really balancing the interests of humans and animals, I mean, isn't this a perfectly clear case for us to say, no, let's end this tradition and show some humanity? And we're also learning, of course, so much about sharks and their role as an apex predator in ocean ecosystems. And when we wipe them out and we've endangered hundreds of species of sharks with our voracious appetite for them, it has this cascade effect throughout these ecosystems. So this is what's happening. We're trying to fill out the map throughout the world to ban finning and to stop this needless killing of sharks. But the biggest of all issues in terms of raw numbers are farm animals. And most of us in society eat animals. We raise 70 billion terrestrial animals a year in the world. 10 animals for every person, or we're consuming 10 for every person. And in the United States, it's even more. The average American eats 30 terrestrial animals a year. A portion of a cow, a portion of a pig, and then about 30 chickens, and maybe a portion of a turkey, and depending upon how widely you range, maybe rabbit or goat or some other animal. But we don't suspend as individuals our feeling that we should be decent toward animals. And every public attitude survey shows that the vast majority of people, almost a universal value, believe that animals raised for food should be well cared for. Yet, factory farms have now become the dominant setting for animals raised for food. We moved animals, you know, starting in the late 1950s especially, and through the 60s, off of pastures where animals could feel sunlight on their backs, they could feel soil beneath their feet, they could interact with others of their kind in normal ways, they could move, they could have a normal life. And yes, at the end of the process, they were going to be killed for food, but not every day had to be miserable and horrible and filled with privation for them. But that changed when we began to move animals into warehouses as a matter of efficiency. And within those warehouses, we then began to confine many of them in cages and crates barely larger than their bodies. And the gestation rates, I'm just going to show just a portion of this video that is images from Smithfield Farms and an investigation that we did there. So I want to show you the images of the farms.
Found are extraordinarily inhumane conditions at Smithfield Foods, the largest pork producer in the entire world. I still remember the first time I ever laid eyes on a gestation crate facility and seeing the helplessness of these animals who have done nothing to deserve the fate that they're enduring. Suffering inside of these crates is just absolutely devastating. The Humane Society of the United States has investigated one of Smithfield's breeding operations.
I'm not going to subject you to more of that, but it's important for all of us to understand what's going on in the food production system in the U.S. There are billions of animals caught up in the system, and they're raised for us. And it's our choices that are allowing this to occur. And, you know, whether you're a vegan or a vegetarian or you're an inveterate carnivore, wherever you are on that spectrum, one end to the other, what we're doing to these animals by subjecting them to lifelong confinement is deeply, deeply wrong. It's not the way for any species to treat another. And it's not the way for a species that says it's intelligent and compassionate to treat any species. This has to stop. And we are absolutely intending to continue to confront these problems because so many little lives are caught up in the system. And we are so disassociated from it. Very few of us have been on these farms. I've been to these hog factories, I've been to egg-laying hen factories, and I will never forget the sight, and I will never forget the smell, and I'll never forget the fear that all of these animals exhibit on these farms. And we have simple choices that we can make to turn around these problems. And we're attacking it from many angles, including by getting many of the major food retailers in the U.S. to say no to this. And McDonald's, which is the biggest fast food company in the world, which prides itself on producing or selling inexpensive food, has agreed, after we began to talk with the company, to phase out the purchase of pork from operations like that. And now Smithfield has agreed to phase out that sort of confinement as a consequence of our campaigns. And many other companies within the last 20 months have agreed to phase out the purchase of pork from these operations. So even for these animals that are so removed from our experience, we're starting to see change. In Canada, we've been working there too, but we've been concentrating on the U.S. as we've been conducting our U.S. campaign against gestation crates, Canada leapfrogged the United States, and now there's a proposal from the National Farm Animal Care Council, a government body, to phase out crates in Canada by 2022. Temple Grandin, you, I'm sure, have heard of her. She works within the meat industry. She says that these crates have got to go. Any sensible person says these crates have got to go. And these battery cages for laying hens have to go as well. 6 or 8 birds confined in a cage, each hen getting just 67 square inches of space. Your piece of paper, your notebook, is 93 square inches. An 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper is 93 square inches. So a hen gets 2/3 the size of that page as her living space for the year and a half that she's alive. When she's no longer productive, then sent off to slaughter and turned into some low-grade product. India, more than 20 of the states of India have now banned these battery cages, and we're working all over the world. The Pew Commission, a group of experts in agriculture, different sectors of agriculture, looked at this issue and recommended the phase out of all intensive confinement systems. I mean, when you look at those birds in a cage, I mean, are we this miserly? Are we this uncreative? Are we this heartless that we would do this to these other creatures? As I said, it has to change. And we're beginning to change the legal framework. These are states where we have standards against extreme confinement. There's a move in Congress to try to wipe these out right now, and we're fighting that. The King Amendment to the Farm Bill seeks to preempt state laws on animal welfare. And a number of states are considering bills, 11 this year, we defeated all of them, to make it a crime to take pictures of animals on factory farms, because the factory farm operators know the public doesn't like the image that they see. So rather than open up the doors and give the animals more space, they're trying to criminalize our documenting of their normal practices by our investigative unit. And you know, it's not just an issue of animal welfare, it's an issue of environment and public health. These 9 billion animals produce massive volumes of waste. Just about all of it's untreated. And it flows into our streams and it goes into our rivers. This is a manure lagoon outside of a pig factory farm. It putrefies the air, it drives down property values, kills fish. This is one of the major collateral impacts. The waste from 300 million Americans is treated. The waste from 9 billion animals isn't treated at all. It retains its toxic properties, and it's toxic when it's so concentrated because all of these animals are aggregated together. When animals were spread out, you know, when we had an agrarian society, it was different. The land could absorb it. Now the land is swamped with manure. 14.5% of greenhouse gas emissions conservatively come from animal agriculture. So it's not just an issue of the farm animals, it's an issue of the seals and the wolves and the polar bears, because climate change is a threat to all of these species, and it's connected to our diet. And as a public health issue, 80% of all antibiotics that we use in society are given to animals on factory farms. Before they're sick, they're used for non-therapeutic reasons because the operators know that it's an unhealthy environment, that the animals will get sick, so we're going to dose the animals as a prophylactic response, which is exactly what we are told by doctors not to do with antibiotics. You're not supposed, when flu season comes around, to start dosing up with antibiotics to prevent the onset of flu. You're only supposed to make limited use of antibiotics because if you overuse them, there will be antibiotic-resistant bacteria that develop, rendering the antibiotics useless. That's why the American Medical Association and almost every major public health group is supporting federal legislation to phase out the use of antibiotics on these factory farms. But the factory farming industry is fighting it. This is the number of animals that we raise just in the United States for food. You can see in the mid-60s, it was just about 2 billion. And then in the 80s and the 90s, it really increased. Per capita consumption rates of animal products increased. It got up in 2008 to 9.5 billion. And then it's leveled off to 9 billion because more and more people are eating more plant-based foods. They're starting to integrate plant-based foods into their diet. 500 million animals are saved each year just because people make casual choices to eat a little bit less meat. Imagine if we didn't eat meat on Mondays alone. 15% of our dietary budget, one day out of seven, we could save 1.5 billion animals just by doing that. Just abstaining one day a week, and we know that there are benefits for our health. We know there are public health benefits because of the overuse of antibiotics. We know there are environmental benefits because of the manure flow into the environment. And we know it's better for animals because that's no place for an animal to live on these factory farms. You know, we've been working in all of these areas, fighting companion animals, equine protection farm animals, to change the law. But in all of these issues that I spoke about, we can't be bystanders. In the face of severe problems of cruelty, whether it's horse soaring or seal clubbing or dog fighting or gestation crates or battery cages or trophy hunting of polar bears or wolves, there's a serious problem that's happening right now in our society. We shouldn't leave it up to HSUS or another group. We need to join together because the history of our country has a narrative where good people stepped up to address issues of injustice. We had chattel slavery. We denied women the right to vote. We forced kids to work when they were 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 years old in factories. We did lots of things that, you know, it's hard to believe that we did, but we did. But we turned it around because we realized that this behavior was unacceptable. Well, on just about every level, the behavior that I've showed you in terms of confining chimps in labs or pigs or whatever the litany of issues that I just gave you a little glimpse of tonight, these are moral problems. You know, in the relationship that we have to animals, we hold all the cards. We have all the power. We are the lords of the animals. And we can choose to use our power in a harmful, exploitative way, or we can choose our power to be merciful. We can be benevolent toward animals. We can treat power as license and do whatever we want, or we can treat power as responsibility and show that we can live up to our self-billing as this incredible species, that this moral species that we know we're capable of being. If the core tenets of a civil society mean anything to us about caring for one's neighbor, caring for the community, caring about human rights, if we accept that notion that it's not just about us as individuals and we're not driven entirely by selfish behavior, then logically we must extend these principles of justice and mercy to other animals. We must, because we know they think, we know they feel. They want to avoid pain and suffering just as much as we want to avoid pain and suffering as individuals. And you don't have to have a PhD in animal behavior, and you don't have to have a PhD in philosophy to make that conclusion. We're in the throes of a major debate about how we treat animals. And for a long time, we accepted it just as our natural right to do whatever we want because might made right. Well, we know too much now about animals. And we've had our political traditions mature enough where our laws reflect the conscious concern for others. I don't talk so much about animal rights. I talk more about human responsibility. It's really more about us than it is about them. It's how we conduct ourselves. And I really invite you to be part of building a humane economy where we marry our values with our commerce, that we don't disassociate our values from our business behavior. Rather than seal hunting, we can have seal watching and generate a lot more revenue. Rather than elephant trophy hunting, which appeals to just a tiny little universe of people who want to shoot elephants and bring their heads back, how many tens of millions of us want to watch these animals in the wild? And doesn't it mean that the elephants are going to generate more revenue if thousands of people can watch one elephant compared to one person shooting an elephant? Isn't humane and sustainable agriculture going to be much more appealing to the consuming public? Aren't we going to have innovations in science that make the use of chimpanzees or rats or other animals obsolete because we can test more reliably in a cell culture with high throughput tests? In all of the areas in which we're working, there is a better economic outcome because the vast majority of people actually care about animals. They want animals to be better treated. This is my cell phone. So I'm grateful to all of you for coming tonight. Thank you very, very much. Thank you for having me. Sahar, thank you for having me. And I hope you get involved with this effort. Thank you very much.